You've heard of James Madison. In fact, we talk about him a lot on this show, don't we? Hi, guys out there at Montpelier who underwrite my show. We always talk about James Madison. And he was quite a guy, and he deserves talking about. I mean, father of the Constitution, author of the Bill of Rights, fourth president of the United States, husband of Dolly, the list goes on. But, you know, he wasn't just a founding father. He wasn't just a president. He wasn't just all of those things. He was a human being, too. And somehow, as a young man, he had to acquire all the knowledge that he used as an older man. That's what we're talking about this week. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about becoming Madison.
Your weekly constitutional is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Professor of Constitutional Law, Stuart Harris.
My buddy Doug Smith at Montpelier introduces me to all kinds of interesting people, and recently one of those people is an attorney from Charlottesville called Michael Signer. And Michael Signer's done something remarkable recently. He's written a book about James Madison, and he's written a book about a part of James Madison's life that is often overlooked. The book is called Becoming Madison, and that's exactly what it's about. It's about Madison's early life, and especially about his education. I mean, where did he get all of those cool ideas that eventually made their way into the Constitution? I mean, they had to come from somewhere. And so he went all the way back. He went back to the archives at Madison's college, where he went to school. He researched Madison's early education, his early teachers, even some of the stuff he got from his own father. And he's written a remarkably readable and a remarkably interesting tale. And I'm going to let him tell you all about it. It all started, as many books do, with a question.
How could somebody like James Madison defeat the mighty Patrick Henry in the ratification of the Constitution? Not to give away the ending, but it's an ending we know because the country we have. So James Madison defeats Patrick Henry.
Spoiler alert.
But here we are. He was 5'4". He was 100 pounds. He was deeply, exquisitely sensitive, hypersensitive. He had a very feeble speaking voice. He was shy. You know, he wasn't shy in a conventional way because he could be extremely warm and charismatic kind of within a circle of trust. But he wasn't somebody who he was very introverted. And he also, as I got deeper into the research and conferred with kind of professional academic psychiatrists, he had what I have concluded was crippling anxiety attacks. And there were a couple episodes that really provoked my interest. I thought there was a book here where during that ratifying convention in 1788, he collapsed twice and had to remove himself from the debating hall while he was facing down Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry was a tall, imposing, highly charismatic, gravelly voiced. People likened him to the Roman orators. That Jefferson said he had never heard anybody as good humored. He could charm a jury into anything. He was, on top of all that, the revolutionary hero. He was really famous. A lot of people saw him as the father of the country who had given grace to a revolutionary country, and who they credited him with the spirit of the victory over Great Britain. So you had Madison kind of facing down against Henry, who was a sworn enemy of the Constitution, because he was kind of an early states' rights person. He wanted Virginia above the Union. He had commercial interests that were going to be hazarded by a strong new federal government. He was suspicious of the elites in Philadelphia who had concocted this plan, and he kind of decided to tear it down. And Virginia needed to ratify it, so this was the last stand. This was the Alamo for the Federalists, for James Madison's Federalists. And so he collapses twice from these attacks, these mysterious attacks, which he had described his whole life as bilious or epileptic. When you get into the research and you really examine what the attacks were for him, it's pretty clear that they were, very clear, that they were anxiety attacks. They're called psychogenic non-epileptic seizures, and they happen to people today, and they're in the modern manual that's like the DSSM, which people use, which is the diagnostic manual. My question was, how did he overcome that debility? What tenacity and fierceness of character, what kind of parallels could there be between somebody overcoming that kind of crippling weakness and that frailty in the country seeking to overcome its own passions and its own frailties? And that was really the nugget of the book, and that was what opened the door into a real story that I don't think had been told, and that was the fun of writing the book.
Well, that sounds like great fun, but now you've really whetted my appetite. So tell me this story. Tell me about the young Madison. How did he become this person?
The story begins when he's 12 years old. He is about to be sent by his father to boarding school with a kind of mysterious guy named Donald Robertson, fiercely independent Scottish man who had immigrated to the United States to start a boarding school. And from the very beginning, Madison bore the imprint of a number of fiercely independent, tenacious, principled, conscientious, and somewhat iconoclastic figures. His father was one. This teacher, Robertson, was another. The book follows kind of some of the lessons that he was taught there at that boarding school in his teens, and then follows him along as his father makes the decision to send him out of Virginia to go to the College of New Jersey, which was a Presbyterian college, very different from the Anglican colleges that were, especially the College of William and Mary, that were dominating Virginia political establishment at that time. And his father sending him to study with one of the big characters in the book is John Witherspoon, who was the famously independent, conscience-driven cleric from Scotland who had been recruited across the Atlantic, who became a revolutionary hero. And he kind of fused this religiously driven independence of thought that was grounded in conscience, that had fused with a certain kind of ethos of humility and a fury, like a burning hatred toward tyranny. And you get at a certain part of the revolutionary character that's so distinctive to Madison, where the freedom of thought, as opposed to convention, so the Anglican Church at this time, which ran, you know, it was dominating most of Virginia politics as well as the College of William and Mary, that Madison was sent out of the state by his father to go study under a man like Witherspoon, who was famous for being fiercely independent, kind of sardonic, really a public intellectual who had attacked who attacked ruthlessly kind of moralizing politics that wasn't grounded in conscience. And he despised metaphysical politicians who kind of drew their rationales and their arguments from ethereal ideas that you and I couldn't challenge. He was a reason-driven public figure. At this point, you only had three professors at the College of New Jersey, which became Princeton. Then they ended up, almost every Princeton graduate became a revolutionary soldier.
And I think sent eventually more signers to the Constitutional Convention than any other college, right?
Exactly. And amazingly, they ended up having this really warm relationship, and Madison and Witherspoon ended up being collaborators in Congress together. Very warm, touching, intriguing relationship that really affected me when I wrote about it. And Madison comes to Princeton, and he just has this burning intensity that he brings there. And very, very curious why he decides that he wants to skip the first year of studies by taking these tests, which he kind of goes crazy for. Then he decides that he's going to cram 3 years of study into two, and he does that with this other student named Joe Ross, and he's sleeping 4 hours a night, 4 to 5 hours a night, and he recalls in his 80s doing this that it almost destroyed his health. It's kind of on this, it's very intense quest to find his purpose and hungrily to kind of consume everything around him. And Witherspoon kind of provided this model for him, and then kind of hits a brick wall when his father forces him to return home to become a tutor to his younger siblings.
Now, before that happened, though, I've always heard that Madison managed to even though he did this accelerated course of study and graduated, then he said, I don't want to leave yet. And so he stuck around. Princeton says that Madison was their first graduate student.
Right. One of the reasons that happened was he was so reluctant to return to Orange County, to his father's house, Montpelier. I argue that one of the great themes of his young life was this push and pull between the kind of suffocating family nest in Orange County, which was deeply culturally conservative. There are these letters after he comes home, which he writes to his college friend William Bradford, where he's bemoaning kind of the provincialism and the insularity and the prejudice that he encounters every day, compared with Philadelphia, which is where Bradford was living at the time. So he ends up resisting his father's pull home for that whole winter and spring, does a lot of extra study, contemplates becoming a cleric like Witherspoon, but ends up being forced to come back home.
You know, this is really funny you should mention all of this. I think you also were a graduate of Princeton, aren't you?
Yes, and you know, to be honest, this is probably where some of this took root. Was 20 years ago when I was there, because Madison kind of lingers over the place.
He certainly does, but I was actually going to say I that's where I went as well, a little bit before you did. But I recall vividly a bit of graffiti that I saw while I was a student there, and it seems particularly appropriate now to mention it. It said, I believe, "Go to graduate school, postpone reality." And, of course, that was just a joke at that point, but apparently Madison's motives were not too far away from that.
Yeah, that's a pretty good insight. So he is hauled back home, and then he's really catapulted into an existential crisis about what can he... I mean, a lot of the books about him have described this period of his life as kind of that he's depressed. I think it's much deeper than that. I think that he was having a crisis of meaning and purpose, and that in that crisis, the way that he hauls himself out of it, you see this singularity of purpose and this tenacity and this ability and willingness to overcome his own weakness that really becomes his DNA as he starts to become involved in political leadership. And a lot of that has to do with the revolution, which is getting going. But then there's this incredible episode where these Baptists, who were this time a kind of roaming sect in Virginia that had churches here and there, but you were required to be licensed to preach at this point by the state. And they were imprisoned in Culpeper, which was north of Orange County where he was living. And Madison, the imprisonment of the Baptists kind of struck him like a lightning bolt. And he found this first core political cause, and he became deeply involved in the effort to free them, which was a kind of a petition gathering. And he kind of says that he harassed everybody that he could. And then the Virginia General Assembly ultimately voted on this.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Michael Signer, who's the author of a new book called Becoming Madison, The Extraordinary Origins of the Least Likely Founding Father. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Michael Signer. Stick around. Well, today I'm looking at a toy sitting on the counter with me that is a little white police car. You're not going to make the siren noise, Doug?
That's a good one.
It's a police car.
I never can distinguish which is police and which is ambulance.
That's more of an ambulance.
I do feel like a Pavlov's dog, though, because when I hear it, I pull over to the right immediately.
Indeed, you do. You could do the German one. But then, of course, you think, you know, like the Gestapo's coming or something. It's, you know, one of those old movies. So, there's variety. But at any rate, it's a police car. So I'm guessing the quiz today has something to do with police procedures?
It's a riddle.
It's a riddle. My goodness. So you didn't wear your Riddler costume.
It's at the cleaners.
Okay. Well, next time. All right. Do we have anyone on the line?
Yes.
Well, who is this?
Hi, my name is Sarah.
Sarah, where are you from?
Bristol, Tennessee.
A fine, fine place. Not Bristol, Virginia. We got to be careful, right?
Yes.
Because those people are bad.
Not bad, just they don't wear orange.
Oh, that's right. I'm guessing you're a Volunteer fan then.
Yes.
Of course you are, like every good person in Tennessee is. Well, thank you very much for calling in. Doug, do you have a good question for this Volunteer?
I do. I actually have a riddle.
A riddle? Okay.
A riddle. All right. Sarah, I'm going to give you this riddle, and I'm going to give you four answers as options. Okay?
Okay.
So you've got to listen really closely. This is a tough one. Very tough. I've got a great sniffer, that's for sure. My search means cops seize drugs galore. But suspicion must be real. The Fourth Amendment is the deal. Even if I'm barking outside your car door. What am I? Am I A, an antelope? B, an aardvark? C, a brown bat? Or D, the drug sniffing dog featured in Rodriguez versus the United States.
That is such a hard one, Doug. I don't know if this woman is going to be able to pull this off. I don't know if I could.
I really like the aardvark answer, but I think I'm going to go with the canine dog.
Wait a second. Don't aardvarks bark?
Aardvark. I like that just because it's a funny name.
Right.
I believe it's the dog.
You know, I don't even think I can make a reasonable attempt to get her off of that answer choice, Doug. That has to be the easiest riddle you have ever posited.
Sarah, your intelligence is tremendous. It is, in fact, D, the drug-sniffing dog, featured in Rodriguez v. United States.
Well, recently. Congratulations to you, Sarah. You're going to get a T-shirt, and so we're very proud of you. But now I'm sure Doug wants to tell us a bit about Rodriguez.
Well, the Rodriguez case is interesting, particularly because we've been speaking a lot about the legitimacy of the law enforcement community.
Right.
And what has happened is...
we're working on an online course right now.
That's right. We're working
on a law enforcement course. Mm-hmm. We absolutely are. But go on, please.
Absolutely. So what happened was a guy gets pulled over. You know, he gets written a ticket. And then cop says, hey, can I take my drug-sniffing dog around your car? He says, no. So he waits like 8 or 9 minutes. And then he does it anyway.
Really?
Well, they find some drugs.
Mm-hmm.
The question hinges on whether there was a reasonable suspicion initially that there were drugs in the car, or whether the cop essentially just kind of goes out of his way just to double check just in case. There was no significant reasonable suspicion. Mm-hmm. And it makes its way all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, in fact, has just reversed the conviction
of Rodriguez.
Rodriguez on the grounds that it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment to, you know, wait 10 minutes and then decide, you know what? I think I will just take my dog around and see if there's anything else I can find on you.
Yeah. Reasonable suspicion is, you know, just, it's a variation. It's a somewhat lower standard than probable cause to believe that a crime's been committed. But the essential concept here is that the police can't simply randomly search people, that we don't want to live in a society like that where the police can just start doing whatever they do to you. On the other hand, if they do have some reason to stop you, then they can do at least a non-intrusive search, like a dog sniffing outside your car. In this case, they actually had a traffic stop, but then they waited. And that was another important thing. They waited several minutes beyond the point where they needed to do the things they typically need to do at a traffic stop. And all of that figured into the Rodriguez decision. So, yeah.
And it was actually a very strong opinion coming mm-hmm. from the court. I think it was 6-3.
Yeah.
And so the court, it's very much on the Supreme Court's radar that this Fourth Amendment issue is something that we're going to really need to tackle. And that's refreshing that the court is having that debate, because mm-hmm. I think localities are having a different kind of debate as well, and probably are siding more on the side of police. But it's part of a broader conversation we're having now, not just post-Ferguson, but really a broader conversation about militarization, police powers, search and seizure, and generally what we expect. How we re-legitimize our law enforcement community is going to be really key for this country. And so this debate, very, very important.
Very important indeed. Well, thank you very much for that, Doug. And congratulations again, Sarah. We appreciate your calling in. And that was a really good riddle, Doug. A little on the easy side.
I think Sarah, she just nailed it.
Is that what it was?
I think she's a dog lover. She hates aardvark.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. I'm speaking with Michael Signer, the author of Becoming Madison, The Extraordinary Origins of the Least Likely Founding Father. And as the title suggests, this is all about how James Madison became James Madison. And we've talked thus far about his childhood and about his early education. And now he's gone off to a place called the College of New Jersey.
Let's mention a couple of numbers here. Now, he graduated Princeton, what was it, 1771?
1772.
1772. Okay, yeah, so right around the time Princeton. I thought. Okay, so he finishes up in 1772, and this, of course, is, you know, right as the Revolution is just starting to rev up, or is in the initial stages of revving up. So that's a time of great ferment. But I also want to emphasize something you just said. It's something people don't recall, is that Virginia had an official state religion. It was the Anglican Church, the Church of England. B, you had to be licensed to be a preacher. And C, this new, or at least not local, religion that's relatively new on the scene, these Baptists, these strange people who dunk people's head in the water, this was an oppressed religion that people got jailed for preaching.
Yeah. And you look exactly, and you look at, I mean, this is familiar to us today in all kinds of ways, that established privileged figures within our politics are threatened, right, by some other. I mean, that's what you'd call it, the capital O other. And at this point, the Anglicans were threatened by the Baptists because they saw kind of a wildness in their religiosity, and they decided to crack down. There's a horrifying story about these people were really starved in jail when Madison heard about them. They were being fed crusts of bread and water only. There's a story about somebody standing outside the cell and urinating into it. I mean, they were just abused and harassed and ridiculed. What was so touching to me about Madison, really found sympathy with them, and the sympathy that he had with kind of, you know, you'd call it underdogs, I guess, really characterized a lot of his politics and a lot of his political philosophy. There's a story far later when he goes to Congress for his three-year term. He was, again, as I mentioned, he was in hock. He was in financial straits, and there was a Jewish moneylender in Philadelphia at the time named Haim Solomon, who a lot of the congressmen went to borrow money from. Edmund Randolph, who was one of Madison's best friends, kind of was, you know, was bitter about having to borrow money from Solomon, and he kind of writes a letter to Madison where he's just using off-the-rack anti-Semitic stereotypes that you'd be familiar with from The Merchant of Venice. Madison repudiated that kind of stereotype thing, and he ended up really making friends with Solomon, and he talks about him with amazing warmth and kindness, and Solomon in turn kind of cut him a break and gave him interest-free loans. And the fact that Madison at this time would abjure anti-Semitism and really find a warm, even connection with this probably pretty vilified character who ended up dying early, a very, very sad story. It just really remarkable to me, and I think it kind of connects through a different side of this kind of little man himself, who had so many frailties himself.
A couple of centuries ahead of his time.
Right.
And this was the time at which he wrote his famous letter to Bradford, wasn't it, about the hell-conceived notion of an established church?
Yes. So he writes those letters in that first 2 years back from college in Orange County, when he's trying to figure out what to do with his life and when the cause is kind of finding him.
You know what really strikes me about this, Mike, from our perspective now is that, you know, I've got a couple of boys, one of whom has just graduated from college and one of whom will graduate in another year or two. And, you know, they and their friends are at that same stage in life as Madison. They're going through great intellectual growth, and then they graduate, and what do we do next?
That's funny you would say that. I have twin 6.5-month-old boys, and so I'm, you know, spending as much time as I can with them, and I'm imagining these junctures in their lives and being their father. I do. I have exactly that same memory of graduating from Princeton, and you read these letters that he's writing then, and there's, I remember Ralph Ketchum, who's this really famous authority on Madison. He was helpful, very helpful to me on this book, and he read and helped with drafts. And he said that he thought that he really praised the richness of being able to linger on these letters with William Bradford. He really praised the way, by focusing on just Madison's youth, a nonfiction technique is kind of slowing down time. You can speed or slow up time just like a movie can. And by focusing on his youth, I was able to get into the richness of these exchanges with William Bradford when he's just like you and I remember being right out of college. The voice is very young. It's very impetuous. It's fresh. It's kind of unguarded, which is so amazing to read, because you think of Madison as so repressed and self-controlled, and he wasn't that way at all when he's right after college and writing. He's, you know, trying to figure out what he's going to do with his life.
I'm stuck in my dad's basement, and I hate being back here, and I wish I was in Philadelphia with you. And can you believe what these grown-ups are doing with this established religion?
Exactly. he writes to Bradford, "I want again to breathe your free air." He talks about how religious bondage shackles and debilitates the mind in Virginia at this time, and he's furious, and he tells Bradford that he's running around, this is when he's 23, that he's squabbled and scolded, abused and ridiculed the imprisonment of the Baptists. And then later on, when he's in his 70s, it describes this as a mere duty prescribed by conscience. But at the same time, he doesn't know what he's going to do with his life. There's a remarkable episode in this book when his father is a colonel in the Orange County Militia. Okay, so the highest ranking position, the Orange County Militia, the militias are the fighting force that's going to take on the British. His father gets Madison, his son, appointed as a colonel in the militia too. Madison spends the summer practicing kind of rifle practice, and he brags to Bradford about how much he enjoys firing his musket and learning how to shoot. And he kind of says, "I can shoot a man's, you know, I could do this from 100 yards." But then when he actually joins the other men for the first time, this is in 1775, so the year before the Declaration. When he actually joins the other men of the Orange County Militia in the fall to do actual practices, he collapses, again, from what I posit are these anxiety attacks. And the source of those triggers, we don't know, but I think that one of them could be this fury that he has at his father's kind of warm but very repressed control that he had over him. At least that's one theory that I came up with talking to some psychiatrists about these symptoms. But he collapses during these military efforts, and he has to. And when he's in his 80s, and he writes a biography, a short biography, autobiography, he recalls this with mortification. I mean, it was one of probably the most humiliating things that you could have. And he never plays any military role again. But what I thought was so amazing was, as he starts moving into government, both as a counselor to Patrick Henry, who's governor at the time, and then when he goes to Congress, military supplies becomes one of his fortes. So and that's one of the trickiest issues, as we know, in any extended war, figuring out how to supply the troops with food and water, you know, alcohol, supplies, shelter. So he takes that on as kind of his burden of conscience, and he really becomes an expert in trying to figure out how to supply the revolutionary troops. And I think he did that because it was one way to compensate for this, again, this utterly humiliating debility that he had.
That had to be just terrible. I mean, there's your dad, here's the great cause of the moment, the great crusade, and you've got your musket practice already, and you go out there and you're resplendent in your new militia uniform, and then you faint.
Right.
You know, in front of everybody.
I think he also didn't faint. He had the symptoms that he had were really an anxiety attack. So I walk through the descriptions. He even described, he would have in his breast and his nerves is what it would say. You'd have horrible stomach aches. You'd have a tingling, perspiring sensation. He would talk about, and then at one point he talks about how these attacks would suspend his intellectual functions. So to find that quote, I had to go, there are many canceled versions of autobiographies. I had to go into the Princeton archives on this one trip there and find it kind of deep within. And so that means that he thought he was going crazy, you know, and that's one of the criteria they use today to diagnose these psychogenic non-epileptic seizures, is when you feel like you're going crazy. And that's exactly what he said. So you had this real attack that he experienced. I don't think that it was as easy as fainting. I think that he had to experience it. And the more that this book is out there, the more I've heard from people who either have had this happen to them or know, have family members or loved ones who have experienced these kind of attacks, and it just sounds horrendous to me. And they are psychosomatic. They are something that's happening because of your mind.
Well, that's very tough, and it is remarkable. I've heard about these episodes, but I don't think I've ever seen such a treatment of them before. And it is fascinating, the stuff that you've found. So kudos to you for finding this information.
Thanks.
Absolutely. Well, so he doesn't do too well in the militia, but he does start moving into government service here. Tell me a little bit about this arrangement he got with Patrick Henry, because I don't think I know a lot about that, this early mentor-mentee relationship.
Well, so at the time, actually, even in Virginia now, I've held several positions I was counsel to Mark Warner when he was governor. So the governor in Virginia right now has two lawyers who work for them. So I've gotten to know about how Virginia government works from the inside. And what's fascinating is that at this time, the Virginia governor had a check on their power. This went to the concerns that the colonials had about unchecked executive power. So they had a governor's council, is what it was called. And it was six, maybe sometimes seven members who were elected. They were elected by the General Assembly, and they served terms working for the governor, and the governor could not make many decisions without the council agreeing with him. So Madison, after the Constitutional Convention in 1776, when Virginia drew up its own kind of revolutionary initial constitution, he got a position as a governor's counselor, very prestigious for him, and so he joined the administration of Patrick Henry, the great Patrick Henry, who Madison had idolized, and he got very close with him, and he was involved in all of the decisions that the governor of Virginia was making at the time. And then, but he ultimately decided that he wanted to go to Congress and go to Philadelphia and join the Confederated government and represent Virginia in the on that stage, and he was fortunate enough to be elected when this seat came up. So the kind of the first act of the book concludes when he's elected to Congress, and he did this kind of remarkable thing where there was this crippling inflation crisis at the time, really ruining the country and very alarming to people because you had galloping inflation. And most newly elected congressmen would immediately hit the road in November, right after the election, to get to Philadelphia before the winter hit, because it's a long trip and the roads were terrible. He ends up staying, decides to stay during the entire winter in Montpelier so that he can figure out the roots of the inflation crisis by himself. And he had ordered books on economic theory, and he basically sits there and in this extraordinary essay, which he never publishes until a decade later, he divines that the problem the country has is not about the money supply itself. It's about the fact that people do not have confidence in the entity which would redeem money, which is the federal government. So he goes into exhaustive detail with a lot of parallels and says, what we have to do is solve the strength and confidence that people have in the federal government, in the entity that would redeem currency. And he kind of figured out the answer that would guide him all the way through a very robust belief in a strong, coercive federal government, you know, right there. And he did it for himself. The self-confidence and the genius that he had to kind of sit by himself for 4 months and come up with this eureka so that he has the ideas and he's the one who could go and try and solve the nation's problems as a 29-year-old congressman. Was just really amazing to me.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Michael Signer, the author of a book called Becoming Madison, The Extraordinary Origins of the Least Likely Founding Father. And one of the contributions Michael's made in this book, we were just talking about, is figuring out the methodology that Madison used whenever he was confronted with a really knotty problem. And it turns out it involved a great deal of study. After the break, we'll come back and finish our discussion with Michael Signer. Stick around. Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion with Michael Signer, the author of Becoming Madison, The Extraordinary Origins of the Least Likely Founding Father. Before the break, we were talking about the methodology, the Madison methodology, where James Madison would encounter a knotty problem that maybe he wasn't familiar with, but then he'd just make himself into an expert. And that even involved, at the age of 29, figuring out exactly what this thing called money is.
There are a couple of things there in that story that really strike me. First of all is the very idea that somebody who's newly elected to Congress and still in his 20s would simply say, here's a major problem. I'm going to figure it out, and I'm going to become the expert, and I'm going to do it from home. I'm just going to go in my library, and I'm going to think about this. And then secondly, it sounds to me from your description that he was thinking about the very nature of what money is.
Yes.
And you know, you'll often hear economists say that money in some sense is nothing more than trust.
Yes.
Trust that this particular medium we choose, whether it's paper or gold or something else, is going to retain at least the majority of its value tomorrow. Even though values may fluctuate somewhat, that the ultimate authority that issues this money is going to stand behind it and is going to ultimately make sure that it is worth something tomorrow. So I can trust it myself, and I can put it in a bank, or I can keep it at home, and I can. This is a reasonable place to store my wealth.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's fairly sophisticated thinking for a guy who's probably never had a real class in economics at that point. I don't think they even existed.
Right. Yeah. He said that money was, the printed bills were collapsing because of an underlying decay in the common, quote, distrust of the public ability to redeem the dollars in the future. Right. So he was doing this really deep read on the role of money, what money was conceptually. And then he was tracing it out through to the biggest problem in the country. And if you look at his great intellectual preoccupation, this is why a lot of the there's some provocative stuff in this book when a year after he got to Congress, he basically decided.
Can I interrupt you, Michael, because you're mentioning Congress here and people might be confused. This is the early 1780s.
Yes. So
and this is the Confederation Congress. This is the Congress which was essentially the entire national government under the Articles of Confederation. So that's what he's basically concluding, that this central government's not powerful enough because people don't trust it to back the money, right?
Yes.
Okay, please go on.
And not just for money, for many other things. For the, like, states at this point are signing treaties on their own, they're printing their own currency, they are trying to, the Revolutionary War is dragging on, and it's very fitfully, and they have their own militaries. It's a disaster for so many reasons. And he becomes with his research bent and he started fusing a sense of conscience with the part of his intellect that wanted to solve public policy problems. And that's one of kind of the big idea of this book, and what I've been interviewed a lot about recently, is what I call Madison's method, which he starts developing now he started developing a little bit earlier. I talk about how when he was in college, he first encountered the Socratic method just in a class on Socrates, and he criticizes it in his notebooks as the quote is captious and insidious. He talks about how it's any lawyer who's listening will know that the Socratic method is basically when the teacher already knows the answer and they make you look like an idiot and and have you learn through your, you know, through realizing what you don't know. So the process of learning is having them guide you. So he thought that it,
law students always call hiding the ball.
Exactly.
Or abuse.
So what's remarkable is that, you know, Madison is 20 or 21 when he's learning this. He not only criticizes it for being, for not actually helping public reason, he postulates that it's one of the reasons that Socrates was assassinated by the mob in Athens, because he basically pissed people off so much, which is an incredible insight. I mean, I.F. Stone wrote this book, The Trial of Socrates, where he spent, you know, a long time studying him and learning Greek, and he comes up with a kind of related insight, but he was a real scholar. So you have this college student who's saying one of the reasons that they murdered Socrates was because he was so infuriating with the Socratic method. I mean, it's not a bad theory. So anyway, so my suggestion is that he unconsciously figures out a replacement for the Socratic method as as a way that Madison starts to use, he kind of creates a realpolitik about of reason, where he figures out how to be politically successful by trying not to play to the prejudices, but actually tackling big problems and winning those debates in public. That is, again, the climax of the book, is when he does this at the ratifying convention in 1788 and defeats a demagogue, Patrick Henry, when the Constitution is on the anvil. But he did this 8 other times before then, and he did it in as varied circumstances as arguing in Congress for the impost, which was going to be forcing the states to give a portion of the revenue to fund the federal government, where he did his first nationally famous speech that was publicized. He did it when he fought Patrick Henry about the religious assessment that was proposed to fund Christian churches in Virginia. That became the famous memorial and remonstrance against religious assessments.
Right.
And so it's 9 parts. It is find passion in your conscience, focus on the idea, not the man, develop multiple and independent lines of attack, embrace impatience, establish a competitive advantage through preparation, conquer bad ideas by dividing them, master your opponent as you master yourself, push the state to the highest version of itself, and govern the passions.
That sounds like a pretty good method to me.
Well, I think that if, you know, to me, the problem was, how does someone who's 5'4", 100 pounds, not particularly attractive, you know, plagued by insecurity, small voiced, you know, the most unlikely person to be a dominant force over politics, how does he get to be dominant? And this, to me, explains that.
Now, is this your characterization of his method, or did he write this down himself somewhere?
This is my characterization, finding all of the commonalities between those 9 instances when he kind of rises to the top. There are just stunning similarities between there's when he's back in Virginia, another example, after having served in Congress, he's a delegate in the General Assembly. And he leads this campaign building on an effort that Jefferson had done earlier to reform Virginia's medieval, antiquated code. So the Code of Statutes, which had, you know, capital punishment for crimes that shouldn't have been deserving capital punishment. It didn't have a lieutenant governor. It just needed to be modernized. And he came in and in a very short period of time, he introduced over 100 bills, and he had, I think, 30 or 40 of them pass. And people, the way that they watched him do this, one man talked about him as if he said, "Little Madison is almost a dictator," because he used this same method where he find passion in your conscience. You look at what this would be like if we saw it more in political figures today. It means that you actually care, deeply rooted in the rightness or wrong, you know, the rightness and the purpose of what you're doing. Focus on the idea, not the man. So he would always avoid ad hominem attacks. He would never attack another person. He always attacked the idea, which gives incredible force when you think about it.
It elevates the discussion, and it elevates you too.
Right, and it makes other people watch you more carefully because they don't discount what you're doing. Develop multiple and independent lines of attack. So what I thought was so interesting about this, when you look at these 9 different campaigns of Madison's, you know, not just lawyers, we're all taught the fancy word is parsimony. So we feel like you have to have an elegant and a kind of, you know, like one big argument is what you look for to defeat something that you disagree with. That's not what he would do. He would, if you look at the memorial and remonstrance against religious assessments, which is the Western world's probably most famous declaration of the ideal of church and state separation, he uses 15 different arguments there. He uses moral principle, he looks at history for how church-state fusion has not worked, he uses he looks at how the states are doing. He uses all kinds of different. He throws in the kitchen sink, and to me that it's just that it's a better way to defeat a poor idea. But to get there, you actually need to really be armed up. So he would spend these months and months of research, giving himself an arsenal to attack a poor idea and erect a good one on its ruins. you know, that goes to this other one, establish a competitive advantage through preparation. So you're looking at, you know, like you go to Congress right now, or I've met with senators before, and most of the times when you meet with a senator, they're surrounded by staff. You know, they're clearly reading from talking points. They're too busy, and they're doing 4 or 5 fundraisers a day. This guy actually would know, he would be the hub. He would know what he was, he had been prepared. He had prepared himself. So he could direct, he was the general of his own campaign. And that just gave him incredible power over somebody who was, you know, just kind of cheaply, representing, you know, this special interest or that kind of short-term concern or this fear or that prejudice. He really was enabled, he gave himself this forcefulness through these.
Well, Michael, that is a big idea, and I'm very impressed that you've been able to parse it in that fashion, but we're running out of time, and so let's get back to the climax. You say that Madison used this method in the Constitutional Convention, in the Ratification Convention in Virginia to defeat Patrick Henry. So could we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So this is 1788, the year after the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. This is in the late spring. Delegates are arriving to Richmond for, to vote on the Constitution. You have to be elected a delegate, and by what they believe, that you needed a supermajority of states to vote for the Constitution, and it takes a little while for word to travel. So they believe that the fate is coming down to Virginia, because enough states had passed the Constitution, but then enough had decided they would not support it, that Virginia really needed to pass it. So Madison is the leader of the Federalists, and Patrick Henry during the Federalist Papers had been what he had spent his time doing in the months between the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, which ended the prior summer, and coming back to Richmond in the late spring. He had been working with Alexander Hamilton from New York on the Federalist Papers, which were basically this blitz of public opinion, PR campaign through the major newspapers. So it's all down to Richmond. The drama is just incredible. I really hope that there is a movie in this, because I think it would make just an incredible climax, because it's a 3-week convention. Patrick Henry is really at the top of his art. He had been declaring. He had become so opposed to the Constitution in the months before that a friend of Madison's would write to Madison and say that Henry would become discomposed in the streets when he would talk about the Constitution. He would become physically kind of out of control, lose it. And the drama that happens during a 3-week convention, again, during which Madison physically collapses from these anxiety attacks twice. Henry, meanwhile, seems to be aided by the heavens. There are these two tempests that literally sweep over the new academy, which is this building, which attack the building with the force of muskets firing and bright, flashing lightning. And it's so loud that they have to stop the proceedings. That happens twice. There's another.
So Patrick Henry is like literally calling up storms to aid him.
That's what it feels like. And yeah, it's and he really and he kind of will stop at nothing. So everything that Madison's method represents, which is how do you use reason and facts and argument to convince people to side with an ambitious, if scary, new idea, the Constitution. Henry had no interest in any of that. Henry wanted to scare and intimidate and seduce using all of his skills as probably the greatest orator in the colonies at the time. Not just the colonies, in the new country. He was throwing it all out there. And so you had, he's very slippery too. So Madison, he would kind of rampage through the rules of debate, and he would try and, he painted the Constitution as if it was this horrifying, terrifying monster. And he also challenged the Federalists, saying that the situation was bad. He painted this kind of pastoral picture of the present of the status quo, and tried to frame them as the radicals. And there was a battle over every provision of the Constitution, and he really was stopping at nothing. And there was this moment when it almost became a duel, when Henry and Edmund Randolph became, who was a friend of Madison's, became so violently opposed to one another that there was almost a duel that happened that night. And so Madison, there's a very sweet, I found it moving, moment at the very end of it when this man named Zachariah Johnson stands up, who had really never been heard of before in the proceedings and is kind of lost to history. But he does this speech where he talks about himself as a man of the regular people. And then he criticizes the strained construction that had been put on the ideas by Patrick Henry in the Anti-Federalists. And me reading that speech and what it represented, there was an undecided contingent in the room. Madison ended up winning them over through Madison's method. And he ends up, you know, people cast their votes with him and with the Constitution ultimately. And that he was able to do that in such a politically fraught context, I think, is kind of the greatest lesson of not just of him, but of what he built into the Constitution. We're supposed to have leaders like this. We're supposed to have, you know, kind of a stratum within our republic that enables us to cast to put our faith with people who are challenging us to overcome our prejudices and using reason and argument to convince us to solve big problems.
And the vote was pretty close, wasn't it?
Very close. And it was Madison had never allowed himself to expect that it would be more than four or five votes, and that's what it was.
Four or five votes. That is just remarkable. Well, Mike Signer, this has been a fascinating lesson, not only in the actual history of the ratification process, but in this method that you've identified, and also, of course, lots and lots of interesting stuff about Madison's early life. So I will encourage everyone to go out and buy 10 copies of your book. Once again, what's the full title, and is it available now?
It's available now. The full title is Becoming Madison, The Extraordinary Origins of the Least Likely Founding Father. There's tons of information at my website, which is www.michaelsigner.com. And you spell my last name, S as in Sam, IGNER.com. And it's received very good reviews in the Wall Street Journal, the Daily Beast, the Richmond Times Dispatch, it's at Costco right now, which was, you know, the number one thing that my mom was excited about is when she texts me and she says, "Your book is at Costco."
So I went down and picked up a copy of your book and a couple of gallons of milk.
Exactly.
And a big, big box of cereal.
As you know, Stuart, whatever works.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Mike Signer for telling us about his new book, Becoming Madison. You got to go out. You got to get 10 copies of it. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our Madison Minute, which we kind of thought would be redundant today, is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. Our scheduling engineers are Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett. And who have I forgotten? Oh, yes, I've forgotten the lovely Claire Winkler, who's joining us today and kibitzing from the side of the studio. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment. Next time on your weekly constitutional, Becoming Madison. James Madison was an icon of the American founding, but guess what? He was also a kid once. He was also a young man, and we're going to talk all about that. Sunday at 3 and Tuesday at 8, right here on WETS HD1 and WETS 89.5 FM. James Madison, you think of some guy in a big statue, don't you? But guess what? He was a little kid once, too, and he skinned his knee and he had to go to school and do all sorts of kid stuff. And that's what we'll be talking about Tuesday at 8, right here on WETS 89.5 and WETS HD1. Next time on your weekly constitutional, you've heard of James Madison, the father of the Constitution. He's the guy who kind of wrote the Constitution. At least he came up with most of the ideas. But where did he get those ideas? We'll talk with author Michael Signer all about his new book, Becoming Madison, The Extraordinary Origins of the Least Likely Founding Father.